Thank you for staying till the end, and hopefully you all are primed to be thinking about bananas now. My name is Gabriel Thacker-Smith, and this is a presentation of my master's thesis that was completed at the University of Hawaii at Manoa on Oahu. So banana bunch top virus is one of the most serious viruses of banana, and it's one of the most serious diseases that banana growers face in the state of Hawaii. As Dr. Brown mentioned, it is commonly believed that there is absolutely no resistance anywhere in the genus, and I thought that was a little silly, given plant diversity, and so I wanted to look into that and actually find out what was going on about it. It was first recorded in Fiji in 1889, and it spread by an aphid vector, which is the sole vector, and it only feeds on bananas, and it takes the virus from banana to banana. And it's present in most of the banana-growing world, except for Latin America. But it's quite prevalent throughout the Pacific, in some parts of Sub-Saharan Africa, and in Asia. So the symptoms are a reduced leaf size and a rosetting of the top of the plant and leaves, thus a bunched top. You get marginal chlorosis and brittleness. Sometimes you get these dots and dashes along the petioles. And if the plant makes it to flowering, which it rarely does when infected, you'll get some flared yellow tips and a highly reduced bunch size. This is the exact same cultivar, which is the commercial cultivar Williams, a healthy bunch, and one that somehow managed to fruit in the presence of bunchy top. And even though it technically fruited, it's a complete loss. So for bunchy top, you can't really quantify how infected the plants are typically, if it's infected at all. Or the yield, rather, it's still a loss. And this is just another example of a severely infected plant. So the current control efforts are either roguing out infected plants as you see them, which is very effective if done, but it's difficult, especially in a place like Hawaii, where we have a lot of farms and residential areas very close together. And so a farm might be really good about roguing all their plants, but backyard growers have infected plants, and so the virus is still present. Enforced eradication has worked in some areas, such as Northern Australia, but it takes a lot of heavy-handed government work and funding, and there's a lot of public resistance to that, people coming into backyards and ripping out your bananas. And aphid control has been a potential possibility, but they're so effective at transmitting the virus that it isn't really practical. You need like one aphid feeding for about 2 hours to transmit the virus, and by the time you find them, you usually find thousands, and if the virus is there, it's been transmitted. So other potential control options that have been looked into are creating transgenic plants. There's some successes with them, a lot of failures too. Either way, it takes a long time to produce something like that, and there's always the possibility of public opposition. There's some work being done on induced systemic resistance, usually using endophytes, that confer some type of mysterious resistance. It's interesting, but it's, again, kind of a basic thing or basic research at this point, and it's not sure how it works or how applied it is in the field. But in the Musa gene pool, Musa is the genus of bananas, there's a lot of diversity. Below are just some examples of different wild bananas, which have a lot of different traits, and there's a common myth that bananas cannot be bred, which, as we just learned from Dr. Brown, is a myth. And so there's a lot of potential. So my objectives were to screen a diverse variety of bananas, both in the field and the greenhouse, for bunchy top resistance, and to investigate also which of these cultivars might be immediately useful for growers in Hawaii. Things we were looking at were BBTV resistance, acceptable fruit quality, vigor and yield, post-harvest robustness, and novelty. So I used about almost 80 cultivars total, about 44 in the field and 35 in the greenhouse. Some were in both. Ones that were in the greenhouse that were not in the field was just a timing issue. We got them in late after the field was planted. And they represented a few different major groups of bananas, and these are groups that I made up, but I think they're very important. They're ones that are close to the currently grown commercial cultivars, so they could be substituted almost immediately without anyone noticing. Only the farmer would notice. They're ones that are similar, so people would still eat them and like them, but they might have to require a little bit of education. Unique cultivars, which are totally out there, and people be like, wow, I didn't even know this was possible in a banana. And then wild species, which would be useful for breeding or for studies about the nature of any potential resistance that could be found. So the methods were, I selected all this germplasm based on those criteria. In the field, there were 6 plants of each variety that were planted in a randomized fashion. They were interplanted with highly susceptible control plants. I established aphid colonies on the all the plants. Basically, I started on the highly susceptible plants and then moved everything to them. But also, before I could get to most plants, there was already aphid colonies present anyway. And after a certain amount of time, they were all tested by PCR for presence of the virus, whether or not there were symptoms. So this is a map of the field showing how the disease symptoms only progressed through time over about a 2-year period. So this is like every few months. You can see it starts on the edge and works its way in. And by the end of 2 years, it was pretty well spread throughout the field, and we could see what was remaining. So of all of the field clones, after 31 months, we had definitely a range of susceptibility. Cavendish, which is the commercially dominant variety, had 100% susceptibility. Apple bananas, which is a common variety here and the most popular, was a little bit more resistant, but even still, they're susceptible. So it's not that they're partially resistant, it's just the number, not all the plants were infected yet, but they're still susceptible. But under here, about 40%, this is what I feel like starts getting to the ideal zone. And there's some varieties that, at least in this time period, never showed symptoms or had a very small amount. So these most desirable clones varied in their usefulness. Two of them that were very interesting were Highgate and Cocos. These are dwarf Gros Michel varieties. This is the variety you may have heard about that dominated the banana industry prior to the 1950s that was wiped out by fusarium. It's still susceptible to fusarium, which is not a major concern of growers in Hawaii. It's something to be aware of, but most are much more concerned about bunchy top, of which these happen to be fairly resistant to. They're also very high yielding, the first bunches being 37 to 36 kilograms, and they are generally great. You can see apple, which is one of the most common commercial varieties here, only yields about 13 kilograms on the first bunch, with a lot less fruit as well. There's also this one cultivar, which I dubbed NPV, because it was mislabeled as Ne Puvan from the gene bank, but when I grew it out, it turns out it's not that cultivar, it's something totally different, and I'm still trying to figure out what it is, but it turns out it's a great banana. And I've handed it out to a lot of growers, and I see it all around the state now, so that's good. Of the wild species, there was actually one, which was a Musa cuminata subspecies malacensis accession that was found at our botanic garden. When I asked the staff about it, they had no idea what it was. They said it's just some junk wild banana that they're trying to get rid of, and I could have as much of it as I wanted. There was no record of it in any of the botanic garden's collection of records. And it's very unique to Hawaii. It's the only time I've ever seen that plant in the state, and I've gone all around the state many times looking for all the bananas. So it was something that was brought in at some point by someone for some reason and has been sitting there for who knows how long. And it turns out it's almost 100% resistant, at least in my study, and, as we just learned, can be used in banana breeding. And so this plant was just as of 2 or 3 days ago made it to the International Gene Bank, and is now going to be available for other researchers to use to breed or to investigate the nature of this kind of resistance. And especially this species, Musa cuminata, it's the wild progenitor of most edible bananas, especially the commercial ones. And it has generally been thought that there is absolutely no BBT resistance, and especially from a cuminata. So the fact that we found one that actually had some resistance and some very strong resistance was very nice. So if we look at the actual field progression over time again, though, you can see that some cultivars, just like these ideal ones, they may have gotten a little bit, but it also came late in time. So even though, for example, Kainja had a 30% infection rate, it only happened towards the end of our thing. So there was a lot of almost over 2 years of disease-free growth. Seen in another way, basically the more purple, these are plants that or reps that did not have bungee top at all. And again, these types of clones, even though you know, half of them became infected, it was only about 31 months after planting. So in the greenhouse trial, these were, again, another set of cultivars, some that were the same in the field, but a lot of new ones. They were hand inoculated with aphids and then screened for symptoms and with PCR later. In the greenhouse, again, it was a similar type of spread of different things, with some being completely absent of symptoms and most being highly susceptible. NPV, which was one in the field that got some virus, didn't get any in the greenhouse, so it's not a perfect system, but it is somewhat representative. These are the greenhouse plants that performed best in the, well, greenhouse performance of best plants from the field. So these were ones that I did actually evaluate in the field and how they performed in the greenhouse. Again, Malakensis, this was that special wild one, even though it was 100% resistant in the field. There was one plant that was susceptible in the greenhouse, but even it didn't show symptoms. It was just by PCR that the virus was detected, but there was never any symptoms shown. So the variability of that is a little bit confusing, but at the same time, any resistance is promising given that it was thought there was none. So again, some of these varieties, this graph shows basically the green part, the green bars are for days, average days to fruiting for the first time, and the yellow are average days to first bunch top symptoms. So there, for most of these varieties, even if they're highly susceptible, you can still at least get one bunch out of it, which actually isn't bad because there's a lot of other pests and diseases that growers could get by planting them more frequently, rotating with other things, having them in the ground for a shorter amount of time. So avoiding bunchy top altogether is another strategy rather than just having resistant plants. This is some interesting observations, but it's kind of more or less the same as what I've been saying. Some varieties, like the Gros Michel clones, had symptoms, but then they disappeared over time too, which was very interesting, even though the plants remained infected, but symptoms were gone. This clone, like NPV, was very slow to get symptoms, but when it did, it also didn't spread throughout the mat, so only part of the mat became infected. Normally, the entire plant becomes infected, but in this, it was very sectional, so you could actually theoretically remove that infected part of the plant and still have those plants live for a while. Like we saw on the map, the symptoms appeared around the border first and moved in. And all of the acuminata, and also I had a bunch of Balbisiana clones, which were the other parental wild species of most edible bananas, all remain uninfected. There was one clone, Orinoco, which had very atypical symptoms. It just became stunted and never grew past a juvenile stage, but didn't have any of the classic symptoms. Ornata, which was another wild species, never was infected in the field, but became infected easily in the greenhouse. And in plants that, especially some of the Gros Michel clones, some of them became infected, but I could only tell by PCR, except also that the fruit bunch had a weird curve to it. So that might be the few exceptions to that bunchy top doesn't, or it's either totally destroys your crop or it doesn't. These ones maybe could sneak by. In the greenhouse, Gros Michel got bunchy top very quickly, but rarely, or it took a long time in the field. NPV, again, was not infected in the greenhouse, but was in the field. And Balankawe, which was an interesting plant, was never infected in the greenhouse at all, but it's an interesting edible cultivar, and I didn't get to plant it in the field, so I don't know how it would behave there. But the conclusion of all this is that bunchy top, or BBTV tolerance, does exist. There are commercially viable cultivars that have enhanced bunchy top resistance or tolerance that growers could start using immediately, such as Highgate. This is one of the dwarf Gros Michel cultivars. Wild species with bunchy top tolerance also exist, and they could be used in breeding, and why banana growers would be wise to diversify, and there's some good options to do so. So thank you for that, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Yeah. The question was, how different are the different like strains or isolates of bunchy top throughout the world? Dr. John Hu, who is a bunchy top and virus specialist, was on my committee, and he assured me that they're pretty similar and that whatever we found in Hawaii was most likely applicable to other strains that are found throughout the world. Any other questions? Yes.
Have you ever considered vector resistance? So resistance to the agent that spreads it rather than looking for resistance or knowledge to the virus itself?
I haven't considered it as a strategy that I thought would be useful, but other folks have looked at the viability of the colonies on the plants and how they differ. But like I said, they are so efficient at transmitting the virus that one aphid versus 100 versus 1,000 isn't always that useful. And so it's possible, but even if you're 90% effective at reducing the aphid populations, it's still, the virus doesn't care, because the aphids themselves have no effect on the plant. It's only the virus. So it's not something that I think would be viable, but it's possible. Yeah.
So I would suspect that there's probably genetic variation out there with some clones that might have resistance to the aphids that would be useful on the level that.
Yeah, it could be, and I haven't looked into that. And as far as I'm aware, the aphids will feed on any banana. I haven't seen a banana that is immune to the aphids, but yeah, it could be out there somewhere.